Olsen says he never even sees her. He's busy barging past all the inmates gathered outside Faria's door, and once he's in the cell he discovers Benito with a knife in her hand. He hits her as hard as he can on the windpipe. For reasons of privacy, there are no cameras in the cells, so we can't check his story. To me, he seemed like a man of principle and integrity. But Lisbeth is already in the cell at that stage. And Lisbeth isn't the sort to stand idle while abuse happens in front of her eyes, especially not when the victim is a woman like Faria. But that's not all.
Okay, go on.
The mood in the unit, Mikael. As usual in prison, no one wants to talk, but even at a distance you can tell that the atmosphere is seething. When I was just passing through the dining hall with Lisbeth, the inmates started rattling their mugs on the tables. They see her as a hero, but also as someone with a death sentence. I heard the words, dead woman walking. Even though it only adds to her reputation, it's critical, not just because of the unpleasant message in the words. It will also get the police thinking. If it really was Olsen who smashed Benito's jaw, how come Lisbeth is the one being threatened?
I get it, Blomqvist said reflectively.
Lisbeth is now in isolation and she's being treated with deep suspicion. Of course, there are many points in her favour. No one seems to believe that someone so slight could have delivered such a devastating punch, and no one can understand why Olsen would take the blame and be backed by Faria if he wasn't the one who hit Benito. But, Mikko, for such an intelligent woman, Lisbeth is being exasperatingly dumb.
What do you mean?
She won't say a word about what happened. She has only two things to communicate, she says.
And what are they?
One, that Benito got what she deserved, and two, that Benito got what she deserved.
Blomqvist laughed. He had no idea why. He knew the situation was serious. So what do you believe really happened? He asked.
My job isn't to believe. It's to defend my client, Giannini said. But purely as a hypothesis, Benito is exactly the type of person Lisbeth can't tolerate.
Is there anything I can do?
That's why I'm calling. You can help me with Faria. I'm going to represent her too, on the issues which led to her imprisonment, that is, at Lisbeth's request. Lisbeth seems to have carried out some research into her background while in prison, and it might make a compelling major story for you and the magazine. Faria's boyfriend, Jamal Chowdhury, was killed by falling in front of a Tunnelbana train. Could we meet up this evening?
I'm supposed to see Holger Palmgren at 9.
Say hi for me, please. He seems to have been trying to get in touch with me today. On second thought, why don't we have dinner together before? Shall we say 6 at Panevino?
Okay, Blomqvist said.
Good.
He rang off and looked over towards the Grand Hotel and Kungsträdgården, wondering whether to go back to the seminar. Instead, he googled a few things on his mobile, and it was nearly 20 minutes before he headed back in. As he hurried past the table in the entrance with its display of books, something peculiar happened. He ran straight into Mannheimer. Blomqvist wanted to shake his hand and compliment him on the discussion on stage, but Mannheimer looked so nervous and unhappy that Blomqvist said nothing and watched him disappear out into the sunlight. Blomqvist stood there for a minute, thinking. Then he went into the auditorium and looked for Marlin. She was no longer in her seat. He could have kicked himself for having taken so long. Did she lose patience and head off? He scanned the room. An older man was now talking up on the podium, pointing at curves and lines on a white screen. Blomqvist ignored him. Eventually he spotted Marlin standing at the bar over to the right. Glasses of red and white wine had been lined up as refreshment during the break. Marlin, glass in hand, looked crestfallen. Chapter 8 June 19th Faria Kazi leaned against the cell wall and closed her eyes. For the first time in ages, she longed to see herself in a mirror. She felt a glimmer of hope, even though there was still fear in her body. She thought about the fact that the prison warden had apologized, and about her new lawyer, Annika Giannini, and the policemen who had questioned her. And, of course, she thought about Jamal. In the pocket of her trousers was a brown leather holder containing the business card Jamal had given her after the debate at Kulturhuset. Jamal Chowdhury, it read. Blogger, writer, PhD Biology, University of Dhaka. And then his email address and mobile number. Underneath it, in a different font, was a web address, www.mukto-mona.com. The card was crumpled and the lettering was rubbed off. Jamal must have printed it himself. She never asked, and why would she have? She had no way of knowing that this card would become her dearest possession. The night after they first met, she had studied it under her blanket while she recalled their conversation and remembered every crease and line in his face. She should have called him right away. She should have gotten in touch that very evening, but she was young and innocent, and she did not want to appear too eager. Above all, how was she to know that soon everything would be taken away from her, her mobile, the computer, even the freedom to walk in the neighbourhood in her niqab? Sitting in her cell now, with the faint first light stealing into her life, she remembered again the summer's day when her aunt Fatima admitted that she had lied for her sake, and Faria had found herself a prisoner in her own home. She was locked in and told that she was to be married off to a second cousin she had never met, who owned 3 textile factories in Dhaka. 3? She had lost track of the number of times she had heard that number. Just imagine, Faria! 3 factories! It would have made no difference to her if they had said 333. She found the cousin, whose name was Kamar Fatali, repulsive. In photographs he looked arrogant and mean, and it was no surprise that he was a Salafist and an outspoken opponent of the secular movement in Bangladesh. Nor was she amazed to learn that it was a matter of life and death to Kamar, that she remained a virgin and be a good Sunni Muslim woman until the moment he arrived to save her from the West. At that time, nobody in the family knew about Jamal. But there were other factors being held against her, not just suspicions about what she had really been up to while she was not at Fatima's. There were also old, innocent Facebook pictures, gossip which was supposed to confirm that she had made a whore of herself. The front door was security locked from the inside, and since 2 of the brothers, Ahmed and Bashir, were out of work, there was always somebody at home to keep an eye on her. She did not have much to do other than clean and cook and serve the household, or lie in her room and read whatever she could get her hands on. The Quran, Tagore's poetry and novels, biographies of Muhammad and the first caliphs. But most of all, she liked to daydream. Just thinking about Jamal made her blush. She knew she was being pathetic, but that was her family's gift to her, because all joy had been taken from her. The mere memory of a walk along Drottninggatan could make the world quake. She was already living in a prison then, but she never allowed herself to give in to feelings of resignation or hopelessness. Instead, she became furious, and gradually she drew less and less comfort from her memories of Jamal. Just thinking of a conversation where words had flown free made every exchange at home feel inhibited and stiff, and not even God was compensation for that. There was nothing spiritual or generous about God, not in her family. He was little more than a hammer with which to beat people over the head, an instrument for small-mindedness and oppression, exactly as Imam Ferdusi had said. She began to suffer from shortness of breath and palpitations, and in the end she could stand it no longer. She had to escape this life, come what may. It was already September. The weather was getting cooler, and her eyes gained a new sharpness, constantly on the lookout for possible escape routes. That was just about all she thought of. At night she dreamed of running away, and in the morning she would wake up still fantasizing about it. Often she would steal a look at Khalil, her youngest brother. He, too, was affected. He was no longer allowed to watch his American or English TV series, or even see his best friend Babak, because he was a Shia. Sometimes Khalil looked at her with such pain, as if he perfectly understood what she was going through. Could he help her? She became obsessed by the idea, and also by phones. She began to follow her older brothers around the apartment, keeping her distance. Her eyes were fixed on their hands as they fiddled with their mobiles and keyed in security codes, but above all she noticed how sometimes they forgot their phones on tables and chests of drawers, and in less conspicuous places like the top of the television, or next to the toaster or the electric kettle in the kitchen. Occasionally there would be a comic interlude when the brothers could not find their mobiles, and argued and rang each other, and then swore even more when the mobiles were set to silent, and they had to track down the muted buzzing. She was beginning to realize that these farces were a big chance for her. She had to seize opportunities when they arose, though she knew how much was at stake. It was not only a matter of the family's honor. She was also putting her father's and her brother's financial futures at risk. Those three bloody factories would be a heaven-sent windfall and make them all prosperous. If she thwarted that, the consequences would be dire, and it did not surprise her that the snare was being pulled tighter. A poison spread throughout the apartment, and now it was no longer just self-righteousness and greed that shone in her older brother's eyes. They were beginning to be afraid of her. Sometimes they forced more food on her because Kamar, it was said, liked his women to have curves, and it would not do for her to become too thin. She was not allowed to become impure, and definitely not free. They watched over her like hawks. She might have resigned herself to the situation and given up, but then things came to a head one morning in the middle of that September, 2 years ago. She was eating her breakfast, and Bashir, the oldest brother, was fiddling with his mobile. Marlin took a sip of her red wine at the makeshift bar in the Fotografiska Museum. Blomqvist had left her happy and upbeat, yet now she was looking like a withered flower, her fingers buried in her long hair. "Hello there," he said quietly. The presentation was still going on. "Who was calling?" she asked.
"Just my sister."
"The lawyer?" Blomqvist nodded.
"Did something happen?"
"No, not really. I just had a word with Leo."
"It didn't go well?"
"It was great."
"So why are you looking so glum?"
"We said all sorts of nice things. How wonderful I was looking, how fantastic he'd been on stage, how much we'd missed each other, blah, blah, blah. But I could tell right away that something was different."
"In what way different?"
Marlin hesitated. She looked right and left, as if to be sure that Mannheimer was not within earshot. "It felt empty," she said, "as if they were all empty words. He seemed troubled to see me here."
"Friends come, friends go," Blomqvist said in a kind tone.
"I know, and I can survive without Leo, for heaven's sake, but still it bothered me. We were, after all, for a while we were really..." Blomqvist chose his words carefully.
"You were close."
"We were. But it wasn't just that we've grown apart. It felt weird somehow. For instance, he says he's got engaged to Julia Danbury."
"Who?"
"She used to be an analyst at Alfred Ogren. She's pretty, gorgeous even, but not the sharpest pencil in the box. Leo never liked her that much. He used to say she was childish. I can't get my head around them suddenly getting engaged."
"Tragic."
"Stop that," she spat. "I'm not jealous, if that's what you think. I'm..."
"Yes?"
"Puzzled. Confused, to be honest. Something strange is going on."
"You mean something more than his planning to marry the wrong woman?"
"You're not right in the head, Blomqvist. You do know that, don't you?"
"I'm only trying to understand."
"Well, you can't understand," she said.
"Why not?"
"Because..." She hesitated, fumbling for words. "Because I'm not there myself yet. There's something I have to check first."
"I wish you'd stop being so goddamn enigmatic." Marlin looked up at him in alarm.
"Sorry," he said. "I'm the one who should be sorry," she said. "I'm making a bit of a meal of it."
Blomqvist made an effort to sound sympathetic. "So, tell me, what's going on?"
"I keep coming back to that time he was sitting in his office, in the middle of the night. Something doesn't add up. To begin with, Leo must have heard me when I came back from the lift, because he suffers from hyperacusis."
"From what?"
"Extreme sensitivity to sound. He hears incredibly well the softest footstep, a butterfly fluttering by. I can't imagine how I forgot about it. But when that chair squeaked before he started speaking today, and he had that agitated reaction, it all came back to me. What do you think, Miko? Shall we push off? I can't stand all this buy-and-sell talk," she said, and drained her glass of wine.
Faria Kazi was waiting to be called for questioning again, but she was not dreading it as much as she thought she would. Twice already she had not only told them about the bullying and abuse in the maximum security unit, but she had also managed to lie. It wasn't easy. The police kept pushing her about Lisbeth Salander. Why had Salander been in her cell? What part had Salander played in the drama? Faria wanted to shout out, "It was Salander and not Alvar Olsen who saved me." But she kept her promise. She thought it would be best for Salander. When was the last time anyone had stood up for her? She could not remember. Once again she recalled the breakfast at home in Sikla, when her brother Bashir had been sitting next to her, tapping on his mobile and drinking tea.
It was a beautiful day. The sun was shining out there, in a world which was off-limits to her. The days when the family had subscribed to a morning newspaper were long gone, and it was even longer ago that their father would have the P1 morning news program on the radio. The family had cut itself off from society. Bashir looked up from his tea.
"You know why Kamar's taking his time, don't you?"
She looked out at the street.
"He's wondering if you're a whore. Are you a whore, Faria?"
She didn't answer. She never replied to questions like that.
"This little shit of a heretic has been looking for you."
Now she could not help herself.
"Who would that be?"
"Some traitor from Dhaka," Bashir said.
Maybe that should have made her angry. Jamal was no traitor. He was a hero, a man who had risked his life for a better, more democratic Bangladesh. But she felt nothing but elation. It was hardly surprising that she had thought about Jamal night and day. She was locked up with nothing to do. But he was free and no doubt going to seminars and receptions all the time. He could easily have met another woman who was far more interesting than she was. Now, with Bashir spitting out his insults, she knew that Jamal wanted to see her again, and in her barricaded world this was greater than anything. She wished she could be alone with her joy, but she did not let down her guard. The merest hint of a blush might be fatal. A stammer or a nervous look might betray her, so she kept her mask in place.
"A traitor?" she said. "Who cares about a traitor?"
She got up from the table. Only later did she realize her mistake. In trying to pretend that she was uninterested, she had overplayed her hand. But in the moment it felt like a victory, and once she had recovered from the shock, she became more focused than ever. She was obsessed with getting hold of a phone. Her determination must have shown. Bashir and Ahmed watched her every move, and no mobiles or keys were now left lying around. The days passed, and October came. One Saturday evening their home filled with visitors and noise and movement. It took her a while to understand what was happening. No one had bothered to tell her that the family was celebrating her engagement. Nobody seemed especially happy. But at least her prospective husband was not present. Kamar was having problems with his visa. There seemed to be others missing, too, people who had fallen out of favour or who had distanced themselves from the brother's beliefs. All of this highlighted the family's growing isolation. But Faria was concentrating instead on the faces of the guests. Could anyone help her? As always, the likeliest person was Khalil. He was 16 years old now and spent most of his time sitting around, looking nervously at her. Before, when they had lived in Valholmen and shared a room, they often lay awake, late at night, talking, to the extent that it was possible to talk with him. In those days, soon after their mother had died, he had not yet started running around the city for hours on end. But already he was different. He was taciturn, and what he liked most of all was to sew and draw. Often he said that he longed to go back home, to a country he had no memory of. She considered asking him to help her run away there and then, under the cover of the party, but her nerves failed her, and so she went to the toilet. It was while she was sitting there, by now used to being constantly on the lookout, that she spotted a mobile, high up, on the dark blue towel cupboard. At first, she could not believe her luck. It was Ahmed's. She recognized the photo on the lock screen. Ahmed showing off, with a huge grin on his face, sitting on a motorbike which did not even belong to him. Her heart pounded, and she tried to remember, she had watched him so carefully, how Ahmed had keyed in his code. It was like an L shape. Maybe 1789? Wrong. She tried a new combination. That didn't work either, and suddenly she became afraid. What if she locked it? She heard footsteps and voices outside. Were they waiting for her? Her father and brothers had been keeping an eye on her throughout the party, and really she should go out now, leaving the phone where she had found it. But she gave it one more try, and it ran through her like a shock. She got in. Terrified, she stepped into the bathtub. It was the place furthest from the door. Then she dialed Jamal's number, which by now she knew as well as her own name. The ringtone was like a foghorn in the mist, distress signals on a dark sea, and suddenly there was a rustling in the receiver. Somebody was picking up. She closed her eyes and listened anxiously for sounds from the hall, ready to hang up at any second. But then she heard his voice and his name, and she whispered,
"It's me, Faria Kazi. Oh, Faria, I have to be quick. I'm listening," he said.
The very sound of his voice made her throat catch. She thought of asking him to call the police, but no, she did not dare. She said simply,
"I need to see you."
"That would make me very happy," he said.
All she wanted to do was shout, "Happy? I'm in heaven."
"But I don't know when I can," she said.
"I'm always at home. I'm renting a small apartment on Upplandsgarten. I spent most of my time reading and writing. Come whenever you can," he said.
And then he gave her an address and a door code. She deleted the number from Ahmed's call history, placed the phone back on the cupboard, and walked out past all the relatives and family friends and into her room. There were people standing in there, too. She asked them to leave, and they did so with embarrassed smiles. Then she lay down under the covers and made up her mind to run away, whatever the cost. That is how it started, both the happiest and the worst time in her life. Marlin Frode and Mikael Blomqvist walked behind the audience, past the display table in the entrance, and out into the sunshine. They passed the ships moored at the wharf and looked up at the massive rock on the other side of the roadway, running behind the museum and the quayside. For a long time they did not speak. It was roasting hot. Blomqvist had shaken off his irritation, but Marlin again seemed to have other things on her mind.
"Interesting, what you said about his hearing."
"Yes."
She sounded distracted.
"Sager, the psychologist who was shot on that hunt all those years ago, wrote his thesis on the impact of our hearing on our self-esteem," Blomqvist said.
"Was that because of Leo, do you think?"
"No idea. But it doesn't sound like your average research topic. How did Leo's extreme sensitivity to sound manifest itself?"
"We might be in a meeting, and I'd see him suddenly sit up and cock his head for no apparent reason. Soon afterwards, someone would come into the room. He always picked up on that before the rest of us. Once I asked him about it, and he dismissed it, but later, at the end of my time at the firm, he told me that his hearing had been a burden all his life. He said he'd been useless at school."
"I thought he was top of his class," Blomqvist said.
"So did I. But during his first school years, he couldn't sit still. If he'd been from a more ordinary family, he probably would have been moved into a class for special needs. But he was a Mannheimer, and all sorts of resources were thrown at the problem. They discovered that his hearing was exceptional, and that was why he couldn't bear to be in a classroom. The slightest buzzing or rustling disturbed him. It was decided that he should be privately educated, and that would have helped him develop into the boy with a sky-high IQ you read about."
"So he was never proud of his good hearing?"
"I don't know. Maybe he was ashamed of it on the one hand, but also used it to his advantage."
"He must have been good at eavesdropping."
"Did that psychologist write anything about exceptionally sensitive hearing?"
"I haven't gotten hold of his thesis yet," Blomqvist said. "But he did write somewhere that an evolutionary asset during one particular era can become a liability during another. In a forest in the age of hunting and gathering, someone with good hearing would be the most alert and therefore the most likely to find food. In a major city full of noise, that same person would risk confusion and overload. More recipient than participant."
"Is that what he wrote? More recipient than participant?"
"As far as I remember."
"How sad."
"Why do you say that?"
"That's Leo in a nutshell. He was always the onlooker."
"Apart from that week in December."
"Apart from that. But you think there's something dodgy about that shooting in the forest, don't you?"
He detected a new curiosity in her voice and took it as a good sign. Perhaps she would tell him more about what was so strange that time she saw Mannheimer late at night in his office.
"It's beginning to interest me," he said.
Leo Mannheimer never forgot Carl Sager. Even as an adult, he could still feel a sudden, sharp sense of loss at 4 on a Tuesday afternoon, the time he always went to Sager's consulting rooms. And he sometimes had conversations with him in his head, as if he were talking to an imaginary friend. Yet Mannheimer did get better at coping with the world and its sounds, just as Sager had predicted. Often his hearing and his perfect pitch were an asset, certainly when he played music. For a long time he did little else but play his piano and dream of becoming a jazz pianist. In his late teens he even had a recording offer from Metronome. He turned it down because he didn't think the material he had was strong enough yet. When he began his studies at the Stockholm School of Economics, he thought of them as no more than an interlude. As soon as he had put together some better pieces, he would make his record and become a new Keith Jarrett. But the interlude ended up being his life, and he was never quite sure how. Was he afraid to fail and to disappoint his parents, or was it the bouts of depression which came as regularly as the seasons? Mannheimer remained a bachelor, and that was no easier to understand. People were curious about him, women were drawn to him, but he was not so easily drawn to them. In the company of others he yearned for the peace and quiet of home. However, he had genuinely loved Madeleine Bard. And that was odd, too, since they seemed not to have much in common. He did not think he had simply fallen for her looks, still less her wealth. She was different, that's how he would always see it, with her bright blue eyes which seemed to harbour a secret, and the streak of nostalgia which sometimes flashed across her beautiful face. They got engaged and for a while lived together in his apartment on Furegotten. At the time he had just inherited his father's shares in Alfred Ugrin Securities, and Madeleine's parents, who set store by such things, saw him as an excellent catch. The relationship was not without its complications. Madeleine wanted to give dinner parties one after the other. Leo resisted as far as he could, and they would fight for hours about it. Sometimes she even locked herself in the bedroom and cried. Nevertheless, it could have been a good marriage. He was convinced of that. He and Madeleine loved each other with fire and passion. Yet disaster struck, and that probably only went to show that he had been deluding himself all along. It happened in August at a crayfish party at the Murnas place out in the archipelago on Verende. The atmosphere had been strained right from the start. He was feeling gloomy and found the guests loud and boring. He withdrew into himself, which sent Madeleine into social overdrive. She bounced around among the guests, gushing about how everything was fantastic, really wonderful. It's amazing how beautifully you've decorated the place, and what a fabulous piece of property. I'm so impressed. We'd move out here in a second. But it was nothing out of the ordinary that evening, just the part of the charade that is life. At midnight, he gave up and took himself off to a quiet room with a book, Mesmero's Really the Blues. He was a little surprised to find it on the shelves, and it meant the party ended up being fun for him after all. He dreamed his way into the jazz clubs of New Orleans and Chicago in the 1930s, and scarcely paid any attention to the shrieking and schnapps-drinking songs coming from next door. Shortly after 1 a.m., Ivar Ugrin stepped into the room, drunk as he always was at parties, dressed in a ridiculous black hat and a brown suit which strained across his midriff. Leo put his hands over his ears in case Ivar should shout or make some other foul racket, as he often did.
"I'm taking your fiancée out in a rowing boat," Ivar said.
Mannheimer protested.
"You've got to be joking. You're drunk."
It did no good, but Ivar did at least put a life vest on Madeleine as a concession. Mannheimer went on to the veranda and stared at the red jacket as it vanished over the water. The sea was calm. It was a clear summer's night, and there were stars in the sky. Ivar and Madeleine talked softly in the boat, not that it made any difference. Mannheimer could hear every word anyway. It was just silly chatter. A new, more vulgar Madeleine was emerging, and that hurt. Then the boat disappeared further out, and not even he could hear what they were saying. They were away for a few hours. By the time they returned, all the other guests had gone. It was beginning to get light, and Mannheimer was standing on the shore with a lump in his throat. He could hear the boat being pulled up onto the shore and Madeleine coming unsteadily towards him. On the way home in a taxi, a wall seemed to rise between them, and Mannheimer knew exactly what Ivar had said out there on the water. 9 days later, Madeleine packed her bags and left him. On November 21st that year, as snow fell over Stockholm and darkness settled over the country, she announced her engagement to Ivar Ugrin. Mannheimer came down with something that his doctor described as a partial paralysis. Once he had recovered, he went back to the office and congratulated Ivar with a brotherly hug. He was at the engagement party and the wedding and said a friendly hello to Madeleine whenever he bumped into her. He put on a cheerful face every damn day and gave the impression there was a lifelong bond of friendship between him and Ivar which could withstand any trials. But deep inside his thoughts were quite different. He was planning his revenge. Ivar, for his part, knew that he had won only a partial victory. Mannheimer was still a threat and a rival for the top job at Alfred Ugrin. He made plans to crush Mannheimer once and for all. Up on Hornskatspuken, Malin stopped for no apparent reason. It was far too hot to linger in the sunlight, but there they stood, uncertain, while people passed them and a car hooted in the distance. Marlin said no more about her meeting with Mannheimer. She looked down towards Maria Toriot.
"Listen," she said, "I need to go."
She gave him a distracted kiss, dashed down the stone steps to Hornsgotten and across to Maria Toriot. Blomqvist stood in the same spot, hesitating. Then he took out his mobile and rang Erika Beria, his close friend and Millennium's editor-in-chief. He told her that he would not be coming to the office for a few days. They had just put the July issue to bed. It would soon be midsummer, and for the first time in years they had been able to afford two summer temps, which would help reduce their workload.
"You sound miserable. Has anything happened?"
Beria said. "There's been a serious assault in Lisbeth's unit at Floodberry."
"That's too bad. Who was the victim?"
"A gangster. It's a pretty ugly business, and Lisbeth witnessed it."
"She usually knows what to do."
"Let's hope so. But could you help me with something else? Can you ask someone at the office, ideally Sophie, to go to the Stockholm City Archives tomorrow and get hold of the personal files of three people? If anyone asks, she can say we're entitled to them on the basis of rights of public access to official records." He gave Beria the names and national identity numbers, which he had made a note of on his phone.
"Old Mannheimer," Beria muttered. "Isn't he dead and buried?"
6 years ago."
"I met him a couple of times when I was little. My father knew him vaguely. Has this got anything to do with Lisbeth?"
"Possibly."
"In what way?"
"I honestly don't know."
"What was the old man like?" "Hard to say, given my age at the time, but he did have the reputation of being a bit of an old devil. Still, I remember him being quite nice. He asked me what kind of music I liked. He was good at whistling. Why are you interested in him?"
"I'll have to get back to you on that, too," Blomqvist said.
"Okay, suit yourself,"
Beria said, and started to tell him something about the next issue and advertising sales. He was not really listening. He ended the call abruptly and continued up Bellmansgarten. He passed the Bishop's Arms and walked down the steep, cobbled street to his front door and up to his attic apartment. There he sat down at his computer and resumed his search online while downing a couple of Pilsner Urquell. His main focus was the accidental shooting in Usthammer, but he did not learn much more. He knew from experience that it was always difficult to find fresh information on old criminal cases. There were no digital archives that he could access. They were protected for public policy reasons, and, according to the record retention policy of the Swedish National Archives, files on preliminary court investigations were deleted after 5 years. He decided to go up to Uppsala District Court the following day and have a hunt in their records. Afterwards he could perhaps drop by the main police building there, or find some retired detective inspector who might remember the case. He would have to play it by ear. He also called Eleanor Hjort, the woman who had been engaged to Carl Seger. He realized at once that this topic was closed as far as she was concerned. She did not want to talk about Seger. She remained polite and accommodating, but said she could not bring herself to look into it any further.
"I hope you understand."
Then she changed her mind and agreed to meet Blomqvist the following afternoon, not because of his old reporter's charm or even her curiosity as to what he was looking for, but rather because of his bold gamble in dropping Leo Mannheimer's name.
"Leo!" she burst out. "My God, it's been far too long. How is he?"
Blomqvist said that he did not know.
"Were you close to him?"
"Oh, yes. Carl and I were very fond of that boy."
After ending the call, he tidied up the kitchen and wondered if he should call Marlin to try to tease out what she was puzzling over. Instead, he showered and got changed. Just before 6, he left his apartment and walked down to Zinkensdamm to meet his sister at Panevino.
Chapter 9. June 19th. She would deal with it. Martin did not need to worry, she said. It was their fourth phone conversation that day, and she did not betray her impatience this time either. But as she hung up, she muttered, "Wimp," and went through the kit that Benjamin, her loyal friend and assistant, had put together for her. Raquel Greitz was a psychoanalyst and an associate professor of psychiatry, known for a number of things, but primarily for her sense of order. She was massively efficient, and that had not changed since she had been diagnosed with stomach cancer. Now she had to start taking clinical cleanliness very seriously indeed, and she was positively manic about it.
Every speck of dust vanished as if by magic, and no tables or sinks were as clean as the ones she had come into contact with. She was 70 years old and ill, yet she was permanently on the go. Today the hours had flown by in a flurry of feverish activity. It was now 6:30 p.m. and much too late. She should have taken action right away, but it was always the same. Martin Steinberg was far too timid, and she was glad she had ignored his advice. Already that morning she had gotten to work on her contacts with the telephone companies and the home care providers. Still, a great deal could have happened since then. That old fool could have had a visitor and disclosed whatever it was he knew or suspected. Although the operation was a risk, it was the only option. There was too much to lose. Too many things had gone wrong in the agency she had been running. She squirted her hands with Alka-Gel and went into the bathroom. She smiled into the mirror, if only to prove that she could still look happy. As Greitz saw it, what had happened had a silver lining. She had lived for so long in a tunnel of sickness and pain that what she now had to do gave her life an enhanced reality, a renewed sense of ceremony. Greitz had always enjoyed the feeling of vocation, of a higher purpose. She lived alone in a 1,162-square-foot apartment on Karlbergsvägen, in the Vasastan district of Stockholm. She had just finished a cycle of chemotherapy, and, all things considered, was not feeling too bad. Her hair was sparser and thinner, but most of it was still there. The cold cap she had worn had worked. She was still good-looking, tall, slim, and upright, with clean features and a natural authority which had been hers since she had graduated in medicine from the Karolinska Institute. She did have those flames on her throat, but although the birthmark had caused her all sorts of difficulties when she was young, she had come to appreciate it. She bore it with pride, and even if, nowadays, she always wore a turtleneck, it was not because she felt shy or ashamed. It so happened that this style perfectly suited her reserved personality, dignified, never overdressed. Greitz could still wear coats, skirts, and trouser suits she had had made when she was young, and they had never needed altering. There was something cool and severe about her, and it was perhaps because of this that everybody made an extra effort in her presence. She was capable and quick, and she knew the value of loyalty to both ideas and people. She had never disclosed any professional secrets. Not even to Eric, her late husband. She went onto the balcony and looked towards Ordenplan. Her right hand, resting on the railing, was steady. She turned back into the apartment and tied it up a little more. She took out a brown leather doctor's bag from a cupboard in the hall and packed it with the items from Benjamin. Then she went back into the bathroom, this time to put on some makeup and select a cheap-looking black wig. She smiled again. Or perhaps it was a twitch. In spite of her experience, she suddenly felt nervous. Blomqvist and his sister were at one of the outside tables at Panevino on Brynkirkagatan. They had ordered truffle pasta and red wine, talked about the summer and the heat, and had shared their holiday plans. Giannini succinctly gave her brother some more information on the situation at Floridberry. And then at last she got on to the real reason for wanting to see him.
"Sometimes, Mikael, the police are such idiots," she said. "How familiar are you with the situation in Bangladesh?"
"I wouldn't say familiar, but I do know a bit about it."
"Well, you'll be aware at least that the predominant religion is Islam. According to the Constitution, however, it's a secular state which guarantees freedom of the press and freedom of speech. In theory, that sounds perfectly feasible."
"But it isn't really working. That I know."
"The government is under pressure from Islamists and has enacted legislation which prohibits any statement liable to offend religious sensibilities. You can stretch 'liable' to cover pretty much anything if you try hard enough. The laws have also been interpreted strictly, and a string of writers have been sentenced to long prison terms. But that's not the worst."
"The worst is surely that the law has legitimized the attacks on those writers."
"The law has put wind in the Islamists' sails. Jihadists and terrorists have begun systematically to threaten, harass and murder dissidents, and very few of the perpetrators are prosecuted. The website, Mukto Mona, has been particularly hard hit. Their objective is to promote freedom of expression, enlightenment, and an open secular society. Quite a number of bloggers have been murdered, around 30, I think, and others have been threatened and named on death lists. Jamal Chowdhury was one of them. He was a young biologist who on occasion wrote about the theory of evolution for Mukto Mona. Chowdhury was officially condemned to death by the country's Islamist movement and fled to Sweden with the help of Swedish Penn. For a long time it seemed as if he could breathe easy again. He was depressed, but slowly he got better, and then one day he went to a seminar about the religious oppression of women at Kultahuset.
And that's where he met Faria Kazi.
Good. I see you've done your homework, Giannini said. Faria was sitting at the back of the room, and she is, one can safely say, a very beautiful woman. Jamal couldn't take his eyes off her, and after the seminar he approached her. That was the start of not only a romance, but also a tragedy, a modern Romeo and Juliet.
In what sense?
Faria and Jamal's families are on opposite sides of the struggle. Jamal supported a free and open Bangladesh, while Faria's father and brothers lined up with the country's Islamists, especially once Faria had been promised against her will to Kamar Fatali.
And who is that?
A fat gentleman of 45 or so who lives in a large house in Dhaka, with a lot of servants. He not only owns a small textile business, but he also finances a number of Qaumi in the country.
Qaumi?
Quranic schools which exist outside government control. There's evidence to suggest that young jihadists receive their ideological training in some of them. Kamal Fatali already has a wife of his own age, but this spring he became enthralled by photographs of Faria and wished to have her as his second wife. As you can imagine, it wasn't straightforward for him to get an entry visa to come and visit his prospective bride, and he became increasingly frustrated.
Besides which, Jamal came onto the scene.
Indeed, and Kamar and the Kazi brothers found themselves with at least two reasons to kill him.
So Jamal didn't take his own life. Is that what you're saying?
I'm not saying anything yet, Mika. I'm giving you some background. A brief account of what Lisbeth and I talked about. Jamal became the enemy, a Montague, if you like. Jamal was also a practicing Muslim, but more liberal, and like his parents, both university professors, he believed human rights should be fundamental in any society. That was enough to make him an enemy of Kamar and the Kazi family. His love for Faria made him a private threat, too, not only to the honour of her father and brothers, but also to their financial prospects. There were clear motives to have him removed, and Jamal realised early on that he was playing for high stakes. But he couldn't avoid the risk. He writes about it in a diary found after the tragedy, which the police have had translated from Bengali and is referred to in the preliminary investigation into Jamal's death. Can I read you a bit?
Please do.
Blomqvist drank his Chianti while Giannini got the police report out of her briefcase and leafed through the bundle of papers.
Here, she said. Listen to this. Ever since I had to watch my friends die and was forced to leave my homeland, it was as if the world became shrouded in ashes. I could no longer see any colour. There was no point in living.
That last sentence was later used to support the argument that he committed suicide in the Tunnelbana, she said.
But there's more. I still tried to find things to do, and one day in June I went to listen to a debate in Stockholm on religious oppression. I wasn't expecting much. Everything meaningful from my past now seemed irrelevant, and I couldn't understand why the imam on stage still believed there was so much to fight for. I had given up. I'd plunged into a grave. I felt like I, too, had been killed.
He's a bit melodramatic, Giannini said apologetically.
Not at all. Jamal was young, wasn't he? We all write like that when we're young. He reminds me of our poor colleague, Andre.
Go on. I thought I was dead and lost to the world, but then I saw a young woman in a black dress at the back of the hall. She had tears in her eyes and was so beautiful that it hurt to look at her. Life awakened in me again. It came back like an electric shock, and I knew I had to speak to her. In some way I knew that we belonged together and that it was I and no one else who could comfort her. I walked over and said something banal. I thought I had messed it up, but she smiled. We went out onto the square, as if we'd always known we would go out onto the square, and then we walked down a long pedestrian street past the Parliament.
Well, I won't continue. Jamal never could bring himself to discuss with anyone what happened to his friends on Mukta Mona, but with Faria the story came streaming out. He tells her everything. That's clear from the diary. After they walked for a little more than half a mile, Faria says she has to rush off, takes his business card and promises to call soon, but she never does. Jamal waits and becomes desperate. He finds Faria's mobile number on the internet and leaves a message. He leaves 4, 5, 6 messages. Still no response. Then a man phones Jamal and snarls at him, tells him he should never get in touch again.
"Faria despises you, you shit," the man says. And that breaks Jamal. But after a while he becomes suspicious and does some investigating. He doesn't grasp the full picture, that her father and brothers have taken Faria's mobile and computer and that they're checking her emails and calls and keeping her a prisoner in the apartment. But soon he understands that something is very wrong, and he goes to see Imam Ferdusi, who says that he too is worried. Together they contact the authorities, but they don't get any help. Nothing happens, not one single thing. Ferdusi visits the family himself, but is shown the door. Jamal is ready to turn the world upside down. But then...
keep going.
Then Faria herself calls from another number and wants to see him. At the time, Jamal is secretly renting an apartment on Upplandsgatan, with the help of Norstedt's publishing company. It's not clear what happens next. All we know is that the youngest brother in the family, Khalil, helps Faria to escape, and she goes straight to Upplandsgatan. Jamal and Faria's reunion is like something out of a movie or a dream. They make love and talk day and night. Faria, who otherwise said nothing during the police interviews, confirmed that. They decide to contact the police and Penn for help to go into hiding. But then... it's so sad. Faria wants to say goodbye to her youngest brother. And she's come to trust him. They agree to meet at a cafe on Norra Bantoriet. It's a chilly autumn day. Faria heads out wearing Jamal's blue down jacket with a hood which she draws over her head. She never arrived.
She was ambushed, right?
It was definitely an ambush. There were witnesses, but neither Lisbeth nor I believe that Khalil lured her there. Our suspicion is that the elder brothers followed him. They were waiting for Faria in a red Honda Civic on Barnhusgatan, and with lightning speed, as soon as they see her approach, drag her into the car and take her back to the family home in Sikla. It seems that the brothers contemplate packing Faria off to Dhaka, but unsurprisingly they see it as too risky. How would they prevent her from causing a scene at Arlanda, or on the flight? Would they have to drug her?
So they get her to write a letter to Jamal.
Exactly, but the letter's not worth the paper it's written on, Mikkel. The handwriting is Faria's, that much is clear, but it's obvious her brothers or her father dictated it, except for the clues Faria manages to slip into the text. I said all along that I have never loved you. That was certainly a secret message. In his diary, Jamal describes how they told each other over and over again, every evening and every morning, how much they loved each other.
Jamal must have raised the alarm when she didn't come back from the meeting with Khalil.
Of course she did. Two police assistants dutifully visited Sikla, and when the father stood at the front door and assured them that all was well, except that Faria had the flu, they left. But Jamal would not be fobbed off. He called everybody he could think of, and the family must have realized they were running out of time. On Monday, October 23rd, Jamal writes in his account of events that he wakes up with a feeling of death in his body. The police made a big deal of this after it was all over, but I don't interpret that to mean he has given up. It's how Jamal expresses himself. He's been torn apart and has started to bleed to death. He can't sleep, can't think, can hardly function as a human. He staggers on, he writes, cries out his despair. The police investigators read too much into those words. That's my opinion. Between the lines, he sounds much more like a man who wants to fight and to recover what he has lost. Above all, he is worried. What's Faria doing now? Are they hurting her? He makes no reference to Faria's letter, even though it's lying open on his kitchen table. He probably sees right through it. We know that he tries again to get in touch with Ferdusi, who's at a conference in London. He rings Fredrik Lordalen, an associate professor of biology at Stockholm University, with whom he's become friendly. They meet at 7 in the evening on Hornsbrookskotten, where Lordalen lives with his wife and two children. Jamal stays for a long time. The children go to sleep. Lordalen's wife goes to sleep. Lordalen has tremendous sympathy, but he also has to get up early the next morning, and, like many people facing a crisis, Jamal is going over things again and again, and come midnight, Lordalen asks him to go home. He promises to contact the police and the Women's Crisis Centre in the morning. On the way to the Tunnelbana, Jamal phones the author, Klaus Fruberi, whom he's gotten to know through Penn. There's no answer, and Jamal goes down into Hornstuhl station. It's 12:17 on Tuesday, October 24th. A storm has just blown in. It's raining.
So there aren't many people around.
There's one woman on the platform, a librarian. The CCTV camera catches Jamal as he's walking by her, and he looks absolutely wretched. Understandably so. He's hardly slept since Faria disappeared, and he feels abandoned by everybody. But still, Mika, Jamal would never abandon Faria when she needed him most. One of the CCTV cameras on the platform was broken, and that may have been an unfortunate coincidence, but I cannot believe it's a coincidence that a young man walks up to the librarian and talks to her in English just as the train rolls into the station and Jamal falls onto the track. The woman doesn't see what happens. She has no idea whether Jamal jumped or was pushed, and it hasn't been possible to identify the young man who spoke to her.
What does the train driver say?
His name is Stefan Robertson, and it's basically because of him that the death was ruled a suicide. Robertson says he's certain that Jamal jumped, but he was also traumatized by the incident, and my guess is that he was asked some leading questions.
In what way?
The person conducting the interview didn't seem to want to consider any other possibility. In his first account, before his brain pieced together a more comprehensive description, Robertson says he saw some wild flailing, as if Jamal had had too many arms and legs. He doesn't refer to it again, and curiously enough, his memory seems to get better as time goes by.
What about the guard at the ticket gate? He or she surely must have seen the perpetrator.
The guard was watching a film on his iPad and said that a number of people passed him, but he didn't take notice of anybody in particular. He thinks that most of them were passengers who had gotten off the train. He has no clear recollection.
Are there cameras up there?
There are, and I've found something. Nothing significant, but most of the people who come up out of the station have been identified, apart from one man who looks young and lanky. He keeps his head down and is wearing a hat and sunglasses, so it's impossible to see his face. His attitude suggests that he's nervous and doesn't want to be recognized. It's a disgrace that he hasn't been followed up on, especially since he has a very distinctive, jerky way of moving.
I agree. I'll give it a closer look, Blomqvist said.
Then we've got Faria's own offence, the one she's been convicted of, Giannini said.
She was about to go on when the food arrived and their concentration lapsed. Not just because of the waiter and his fussing with the plates and the grated parmesan, but also because a group of noisy youths came by on their way towards Iterstad Tvergrend and Kinnevik-Sveriet. Palmgren was thinking about the war in Syria, and all sorts of other miseries, including the pain which felt like knives in his hips, and about the idiotic call he had made to Martin Steinberg. He was also terribly thirsty. He had drunk very little, and he hadn't had anything to eat either. It would still be a while before Lulu arrived and took him through his evening ritual, if indeed Lulu was coming at all. It seemed as if nothing was working. His phones certainly weren't, neither of them, and no help had come, not even Marita. He had spent all day lying in bed, getting more and more upset. He really should trigger his alarm. He wore it on a cord around his neck, and although he was reluctant to use it, now seemed the right time. He was so thirsty he could hardly think straight. It was warm, too. No one had aired his room or opened a window all day. No one had done anything. Almost in desperation, he listened out for sounds in the stairwell. Was that the lift? You could hear the lift all the time. People came and went, but nobody stopped at his door. He swore and turned in his bed and felt terrible shooting pains. Instead of calling Professor Steinberg, who was probably a crook, he should have gotten in touch with a psychologist who was also mentioned in the confidential notes, the one named Hilda von Canterbourg, who was said to have breached her duty of confidence by talking to Lisbeth's mother about the registry. If anyone could have helped him, surely it was she, rather than the one who ran the whole project. What a prize donkey he had been, and how dreadfully thirsty he was. He considered shouting as loudly as he could in the direction of the stairwell. Perhaps one of the neighbours would hear him. But wait. Now he heard footsteps heading his way. A smile spread across his face. That must be Lulu. His wonderful Lulu. As the door opened and closed and shoes were wiped on the doormat, he called out with his last reserves of strength.
"Hello, hello! Now tell me all about Hanninger. What was his name again?"
He got no answer, and now he could hear that the steps were lighter than Lulu's, more rhythmic and somehow harder. He looked around for something to defend himself with. Then he breathed out. A tall, slender woman in a black turtleneck appeared in the doorway and smiled at him. The woman was 60, maybe 70 years old, and she had sharp features. There was a cautious warmth in her eyes. She was carrying a brown doctor's bag, which seemed to belong to another era, and she held herself upright. There was a natural dignity about her. The smile was refined.
"Good afternoon, Herr Palmgren," she said. "Lulu is very sorry that she can't come today." There's nothing wrong with her, I hope.
No, no, it's just a personal matter, nothing serious, the woman said, and Palmgren felt a sting of disappointment. He could sense something else, too, but he could not quite put his finger on it. He was far too dazed and thirsty.
Could you please bring me a glass of water?
Oh, my goodness, of course, the woman said, and she sounded just like his old mother all those years ago. She put on a pair of latex gloves and went off, returning with two glasses. He drank with a shaky hand and felt that the world was getting its colour back. The water restored him to some sort of stability. Then he looked up at the woman. Her eyes seemed warm and affectionate, but he did not like the latex gloves, or the hair, which was thick and did not suit her at all. Was she wearing a wig?
"Now that's better, isn't it?" she said. "Much better. Are you temping for the care company?
I sometimes help out in an emergency. I'm 70, so sadly they don't like to call on me too often," the woman answered, and unbuttoned his nightshirt, which was damp with sweat after the long day in bed. She took a morphine patch from the brown leather bag, raised his medical bed, and swabbed a patch high up on his back with a cotton ball. Her movements were precise, her touch careful. She knew what she was doing, no question about it. He was in good hands. There was none of the clumsiness of some of the other helpers. But it also made Palmgren feel vulnerable. The woman's professionalism was almost too much.
"Not too fast," he said.
"I'll be careful. I read about your pain in the notes. It sounds very unpleasant."
"It's bearable."
"Bearable," she repeated. "That's not good enough. Life should be better than that. I'll give you a slightly stronger dose today. I think they've been a bit stingy with you."
"Lulu,"
he began. "Lulu's wonderful, but she isn't the one who decides about the morphine. That's beyond her authority," the woman interrupted, and with her practiced hands, her easy mastery, she applied the patch. It felt as if the morphine was taking effect immediately.
"You're a doctor, aren't you?"
"No, no, I never got that far. For many years I was an ophthalmic nurse at Sofiahem at—"
"Is that so?"
he said, and he seemed to detect something tense about the woman, a twitch around her mouth. But perhaps it was nothing. Or so he tried to tell himself. Still, he could not help examining her face more closely now. She had a certain class, didn't she? But there was nothing classy about her hair. Or her eyebrows, for that matter. They were the wrong colour and style, and they looked as if they'd been stuck on in a hurry. Palmgren thought how strange his day had been, and recalled the conversation of the day before. He looked at the woman's turtleneck. What was it that bothered him about it? He could not think straight. The air was too close and hot. Without really being conscious of it, his hand moved towards his personal alarm.
"Could you please open a window?"
he asked. She did not answer. She stroked his neck with soft, deliberate movements. Then she removed the cord with the alarm from around his neck, and with a smile said, "The windows will have to stay closed."
"Eh?"
Her response was so unpleasant in its austerity that he could hardly take it in. He stared at her in astonishment and wondered what to do. His options were limited. She had taken away his alarm. He was lying down, and she had her medical bag and all her professional efficiency. And it was odd. The woman looked blurred, as if she were moving in and out of focus. Suddenly he understood. Everything in the room was becoming hazy. He was drifting away. He slid into unconsciousness, fighting against it with all his strength. He shook his head, waved his good hand, gasped for air. All the woman did was smile, as if in triumph, and put another patch on his back. Then she put his nightshirt back on, straightened his pillow, and lowered his bed. She gave him a few gentle pats, as if she wanted to be especially nice to him in some sort of perverse compensation.
"Now you're going to die, Holger Palmgren," she said. "It's about time, isn't it?"
Janini and Blomqvist sipped their wine and were silent for a little while as they looked up towards Kinnevik's period.
"Faria was probably more afraid for her own life than for Jamal's," Janini said. "But the days passed and nothing happened. We don't know a great deal about what went on in the apartment in Sikla.
Her father and brothers gave such a consistent and embellished account that it can only have been false. But we can be sure that they felt under pressure. There was talk in the neighbourhood, and reports were made to the police. They may have been having a tough time keeping Faria under control. "Two things we know for sure," Giannini went on.